Hey, it's Francis Lam. Thanks so much for downloading this week's podcast. And if you ever want more info on anything you hear on our show, you can always find it at splendidtable.org. Recipes, videos, more on our guests, and you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's all about getting you good things to eat and make on weeknights. But right now, here's this week's podcast. It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lam. You know, I don't know that I'd really want to be a full-time vegetarian, but I have to tell you that when it comes to the sheer variety of tastes and textures, I'm a huge fan of the plant kingdom. And this week, we're taking a look at some of its more underappreciated citizens. Things like a particular kind of edible flower that you might find growing by where you park your car, or crazy delicious sauces made by pureeing vegetables with fried almonds, or fruit helped along with just a little bit of cake batter baked on top. But first, we're going to go green. When I first started cooking for my wife, which is to say, back when we were falling in love and realized we wanted each other to live forever, we had this little chant we'd do anytime I put collards or broccoli rabe on the table. Dark leafy greens! Dark leafy greens! We cheered for them like they were the hometown team because we're pretty convinced dark leafy greens will help you live forever. They're packed with vitamins and fiber and antioxidants and probiotics and all kinds of stuff I don't actually know anything about, but it feels great to eat stuff you know is good for you. Still, we eventually stopped thinking about greens' health benefits because we're just so happy to eat them because they're delicious. And the chef Jen Lewis feels the same way. She spent 2 years writing a new book, The Book of Greens. It's an A to Z collection of dozens of different kinds of greens and tons of recipes for what to do with them. Chef, so great to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Francis.
This is a beautiful book. And it's so chock full of information on all these different kinds of greens. And, you know, I'm flipping through it, and the first one in the book is agretti, and I've literally never even heard of agretti. So, and, you know, there are like 300 more pages to go. So you might be the exact wrong person for me to say this to, but aren't most greens really the same? I love them.
That's a fair question. I mean, it's interesting because in the process of writing the book, I thought a lot about greens, the flavor profile of greens and what you use when you cook them. And there's a lot of similarities as far as what do greens taste like? Chlorophyll, right? So you have greener tasting greens. You have lemonier tasting greens. You know, I found myself over and over using, you know, a salty pork product, a lemon, anchovy, garlic. But they are green tasting.
Yeah.
Some are really hearty, like a kale or collards. Some are really delicate, like butter lettuce. And so I kind of thought about how they work seasonally, how they work texturally as far as the best uses for them. So like butter lettuce, you don't want to braise that. You could saute it really briefly and have a little bit of heat on it, but too much heat would really break it down. But then I would think about it as a fresh salad or... like in the book, I did a butter lettuce panna cotta, and I infused the flavor of those really tender inner leaves with cream and made a dessert with it and paired it with strawberries.
Oh, my God.
It's cool. Right. And so I really thought about them as the texture of the green, how much flavor they have. You know, I made shumai, and I put collard greens in there, and collard greens go great with Chinese food, and they hold up to pork really well. And so I looked at just different places where I could fit, you know, aloe into a cocktail and where greens would add nutrition to food, add flavor to food, whether it be that lemony chlorophyll or the grassy chlorophyll flavor.
And so when you're talking about the shumai, these are like the sort of open skin dumplings. And so you just chop them up and put them in there with the
Yeah,
filling?
I sauteed them with some mushrooms and added them to the pork and filled the wonton wrappers with them and steamed them. And so you have that extra flavor, extra texture. And, you know, most cultures outside of the U.S. serve greens in all different dishes. And they're not just a side salad or or a braised green side. They put them in all different dishes. And we don't tend to do that here. And so it was kind of a fun look at, you know, internationally how greens are used.
You know, I haven't really thought of it like the way you're describing. But I do know when I'm at the market and I see a nice head of whatever, I see a nice bunch of collards, and I'll buy that without even knowing what to do with it. But I'll be like, okay, that's dinner on Tuesday. I'm going to figure out what to do with that. And usually Tuesday comes and I'm lazy, and what I'll do is I'll, you know, braise it down with maybe a little of anchovy and toss it with pasta. Or like it ends up being something very simple like that. But cooking a green as the focal point of a meal is something that does feel so intuitive in so many cultures. You're so right. So what are some of the more hidden all-stars for you? You have, you know, this big book of, you know, dozens and dozens of greens. What are some of the more underappreciated or unique ones that you've come across?
Well, I kind of like to think about the greens in three different kind of categories of how you get them. So you go to your grocery store and you can get kale, you can get arugula, you can get iceberg, you can get all those, you know, very common greens. And then you go to the farmer's market and you can get more unique greens, whether it be more heirloom varieties or something a little bit more unique, like maybe some cool mustard greens that you don't see in the grocery store. And then the third way that I think you find the most cool little gems is that you plant a garden. And I have a really cool garden at my house. It's an urban garden and it's pretty big and I grow a lot of food. And I try to grow varieties or vegetables that you can't get at the farmer's market or the grocery store. And the other hidden gems are stuff that you find when you're traveling. When I was writing this book, I had two trips, one to Vietnam and one to Hong Kong. And I was blown away by the varieties of greens in Asia. So, and again, Asian grocery stores are amazing resources for cool greens. But I think that there's really, some of them are really interesting, like chickweed. It kind of reminds me of what you find on the playground, you know, in the grass. It's really, really nutritious, and it's very lemony flavored. And so it pairs nicely with something a little sturdy, or it could be accompanied raw with something cooked. Like in the book, I have it with arepas, and there's an egg that's cooked in the arepa. And so it's something that's clean, a clean flavor paired with something that's a little richer.
Oh, yeah, I love that. The arepas, they're like corn cakes, like really thick tortillas, essentially. And they're sort of heavy and they're earthy. And I love the idea of that lemony green with that. That's super
cool.
Yeah,
it's nice because it cleans it up, you know? I have this wonderful recipe I love. It is for salted herbs, and it's something that they use in Eastern Canada, so like near Montreal. And you take carrots and celery, etc., and you salt them, and they preserve, and you use them to season food. And it's something that's really unique. And I did them, and it had green onions and Vietnamese coriander leaves and chives and endive and celery and carrots. And so it's crunchy, but super salty, and it preserves in the fridge for a good solid, you know, 2-3 weeks. And you can season fried rice with it. You can season a soup with it or scrambled eggs. And it's a way to season your food, but you have all of that other flavor from the vegetables in it.
Do you chop up all the herbs?
Yeah, everything's chopped up pretty finely. All the vegetables pick up all of the flavor from the salt and kind of become part of that salty flavor.
You know, when you were talking about hidden gems before, my mind immediately went to beets or turnips, and I buy them and they come these beautiful bunches of greens on top, and everyone takes them, cuts them, throws them away, and one day I realize, no wait, that's food. Like I just got
Absolutely.
Free food with my food. So
I know,
talk about the free food that comes with your food.
I know, that's hilarious. It's true. And having a conversation recently with someone, I said, did you know that broccoli has leaves? And they're like, what?
They're the best.
I know, and you never see them because where do they go? They clip them off, and I think it's for perishability reasons. I think that the leaves will deteriorate before the head of broccoli, and so for you know, mass production, they take the leaves off. But there's all these leaves that are really delicious, and you know, beet greens are unique because they're going to have that beety redness. And so if you don't want your food that you're going to include your beet greens into to turn red, blanch them first and squeeze them out so that a lot of that color comes out. But there's all these leaves, cauliflower leaves. They can be pretty fibrous, so you can cut them kind of fine and toss them in with your stir fry. You can toss them in with your pasta. You know, carrot greens make salsa verde. It's nice with carrot greens because they're pretty grassy flavored. It's kind of nice to cut them with a few other herbs like basil or mint and balance them out. But all of these things can be used and eaten, and they're food. Free food with your food.
Yeah, so I am totally on team, you know, green leaves that come stuck to other things that you should also eat. But there was one in their book that I was really surprised by, and that's tomato leaves. Because I've never tried to eat them, but I remember touching them one time on a friend's tomato plant. I couldn't get the smell off me, and I was like, that's got to be poison, right? Like, but you can eat tomato leaves.
Right. Most people think they are poisonous, and they're not. They are a part of the nightshade family. They're not poisonous. I have put them in a bunch of different things. They are a little fuzzy at times, so sometimes cooking them like nettles, you don't want to eat raw. But I have a recipe for putting them in pasta and basically blanching them and then putting them in with the egg and the liquid and making your pasta with them. And they're delicious. They have a great flavor. I love cooking with them. Same with squash vine leaves. People don't think you can eat the leaves from your zucchini plant. And there's a wonderful Sicilian soup, and they use the squash leaves.
I love that you're opening minds to the other free food that comes with your food.
For sure.
Thank you so much. I feel so green smoothie energized right now. Thank you so much, Jen, for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Jen Lewis is the chef of Ray Restaurant in Portland, Oregon, and the author of The Book of Greens. And from that book, she left us with a recipe for that terrific condiment, salted herbs. Oh, and another one for that crazy dessert she came up with, butter lettuce panna cotta. You'll find both those recipes at splendidtable.org. And you know, I was kind of just kidding with Jen when I asked her if all greens were really the same, but honestly, as much as I love them, I do think greens mostly taste like variations of one another, which means you can usually swap them with impunity. So here's what I do when I'm shopping and come across greens I've never had before. I'll grab a leaf, I'll pop it in my mouth, and I see how it goes. Now, there's a very slim chance that the greens you're looking at might be inedible raw, like stinging nettle, so if you're ever unsure, ask first. But when I'm chewing, I'm looking first for the texture. Is it delicate or chewy or tough? If it's firmer, I think about braising it with some onions and garlic and maybe like, you know, a bacon-like thing. Or with soy sauce or fish sauce with some mushrooms and a touch of sugar, that's so good. And if the texture is light and delicate, you know, then you think about a salad, or maybe a quick wilt in a pan. And if the texture is somewhere in the middle, you can think about sautéing it, maybe with some chili flakes and lemon, or with a little bit of ginger and oyster sauce. Or the other way to think about it is to go by flavor. If the greens are sweet, consider eating them raw or just cooking very lightly. If they're sharp and mustardy, then blanch them or sauté them. And if they're deep and bittersweet, then braise them down. It's basically a framework of the more intense the greens are, the more you cook them to mellow them out. It's a pretty simple concept, but it works almost all the time. Coming up, the smoky, chunky world of Spanish sauces and a dessert that's going to zonk you out. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lamb. When you think of Spanish food, what do you think of? Probably paella, or incredible hams, or classic tapas like the tortilla española, you know, a giant egg and potato omelet that might be the very best thing you can do with eggs, potatoes, onions, and a metric ton of olive oil. But what's interesting is that these classic Spanish dishes aren't usually served with sauces. And so we don't equate Spanish food with sauces, and I think we're missing out, because Spain is the birthplace of some of the most delicious, interesting sauces on earth. Rusty red purees of peppers, fried bread, and almonds, and thick dips you want slathered over grilled meat, and of course, the king of sauces, mayonnaise. our producer Sally Swift sat down with Spanish chef Omar Alaboy for a tour of Spain's sauces.
Hey Omar, great to have you.
Hello, thank you.
You know, when I was just starting to really cook, I was lucky enough to stumble upon a recipe for Romesco sauce. And I am telling you, that sauce changed my life as a cook. You Spaniards know what you're doing.
Yeah, no, it's one of the favorites and very commonly used, particularly on the east coast of Spain.
So describe it for our listeners.
So Romesco, it has a mix of fried bread, toasted or fried nuts. It could be pine nuts, hazelnuts, or generally almonds, and some roast vegetables as well, and some spices, and roasted tomato. And you just blend it all together, sort of coarse, not in a smooth, thin puree. And it can be enjoyed with fish, meat, vegetables, and
fingers.
Actually,
it's delicious.
Fingers. I was just about to say, when spring onions are in season in Spain in February, we have a particular spring onion in Catalonia, which is the calçot, which is a very, very sweet spring onion, and we charcoal them over the open fire. On the barbecue, and we just peel off the burnt skin outside, and it's a very succulent, very sweet spring onion inside, and we just dip them like if it was fingers. And we make a major festival called the calçotada as well, and that will be when most of that sauce is consumed in that particular day of the year.
And the other thing about that sauce that was so surprising to me as a young cook was that big hit of vinegar in it.
Yes, sherry vinegar, a very, very strong, very acidic, you know, because it's generally quite old vinegar as well, and we mature it in wood barrels, particularly with the leftovers of the sherry wine that we do in the south of Spain. Gives incredible intensity to the sauce. And as well, the sauce itself is a bit of split. It's not fully emulsified in any way. You know, it has the coarse bits of bread, the almonds. It's chunky, yes.
Mm-hmm. It's thick. It's a thick sauce. So can you give me a couple more Spanish, what I consider to be mother sauces? What are other sauces that Spaniards put to use all the time?
So one of the historic sauces will be, which probably most people considers French, you know, like most of mother sauces, because it was spread by Auguste Escoffier, and it was the sauce espagnole, which translates as Spanish sauce.
Which, what is and, that? I actually don't know what that is.
It's like a demi-glace or, you know, it's like a thick gravy of the reduction of the stock made with beef bones and roasted vegetables. And it is a very common sauce in Spain, and it was written about in the 19th, 18th century, and that's where he got it from, and that's why he called it sauce espagnole. And as you know, we use it in all sorts of stews, pork cheeks, beef stews generally, that type of thing. And as well, there is obviously plenty of variations. You know, that is the mother sauce, as you said, but then you can add chocolate to it, burnt caramel to it. You can emulsify it with butter as well, depending on the purpose and the use you're going to make.
Can you explain to me what a mojo is? Is that an important sauce in Spain?
Yes. Mojo, as we said, comes from the Canary Islands. And which is, you know, Canary Islands is more, you know, physically and geographically, it's more on Africa than it is actually in Spain. And there is a couple of them, mojo picón, which translates as spicy mojo, and mojo verde, green mojo. And they are both very similar to Romesco in its essence, in the same way they have extra virgin olive oil and vinegar, that is the base of the sauce. But the mojo picón is done with dried red chilies, as well with fried bread, cumin seeds, and some other things. And the mojo verde is done with green fresh chilies and coriander. Coriander being a herb that, you know, it's very common for all of us, but it originated in the Canary Islands, actually. So those two sauces, they are very distinctive, very punchy, quite acidic. And they, again, mojo verdes are normally used with fish, and mojo pico more with meat. And then we have this very particular recipe in the Canary Islands, which I thought the world should know about, which are wrinkly potatoes. So, and let me explain.
Which are what?
Wrinkly, uh-huh. Like for wrinkles. Yeah. And let me explain you the reason why the potato wrinkle. They are smaller potatoes, like new potatoes. And we only just cover them with water, like about two fingers. And then you let them boil. And obviously that water will dehydrate in about 20 minutes, which is about the time that the new potato takes to cook, mm-hmm. with plenty of salt. Mm-hmm. And then when the water totally dehydrates from the pot, mm-hmm. you just stir the potatoes. And then everything that is left is the salt, which creates a bit of a crust around it. And as they cool down, they just wrinkle completely. And let me tell you, that is a great way and very healthy way of eating potatoes.
Oh, what a great idea. So you're literally letting all of the water boil away from the potatoes and it finally finishes and crisps up in the salt.
Exactly that. Yeah.
That sounds exactly excellent. That. And you would serve that with the mojo?
With the mojo, both mojos, actually. Okay. You put them both and you just dip whichever way you want.
So those sauces that involve nuts, is that what a picada is? Or is that...
Yes, it is. It is. Let me explain. I was saying the romesco comes from Catalonia, which Catalonia is on the northeast of Spain, just bordering with mm-hmm. France. So just below that region, it's Valencia and Murcia. And as well, just on the right of it, we have the Balearic Islands, Ibiza, Mallorca, that probably people is familiar to, Menorca. And all of that area is, we've grown historically plenty of almonds, which the Arabs brought from North Africa. Spain is now actually, after the USA, the second largest almond producer in the world. Mm. So we have plenty of sauces done with almonds, which we generally call picadas, which again are either dressings that you can use to your liking with salads or topping a variety of recipes like fish or meat and so on, or as well that we use to thicken up sauces. And a great example of that will be a suquet, which is like a fisherman type of stew with plenty of saffron. And what we do, the picada, for example, in that case, will be saffron, fried bread, toasted almonds, and a bit of paprika as well, and olive oil. And you would just pestle and mortar it. I don't know how you say it.
Mortar and pestle it. Yep.
Mortar and pestle it. Yeah. And grind it into a paste. And then you add it to your fish stews or so on, and it gives a fantastic taste, obviously, as well as thickening up the sauces. And they are very, very common.
Wow, it sounds great. That's what's so interesting about the Spanish take on sauces. They're so often thickened.
Yes. And our staple food, you know, in the UK will be potatoes. In Asia will be rice. In Spain, it's bread. Mm-hmm. We mop with bread every sauce. Bread is our daily thing, like in France. And so we use bread as well to thicken a lot of sauces. We use almonds, as I was saying. Egg yolks, funny enough, that was the eldest thickening agent.
Oh.
But we would use it boiled. We would boil the eggs, take the egg yolk, and dilute it in water. When you bring that to the boil, whatever stew you're doing, then it will thicken.
That's a great idea.
And, well, talking about egg yolk, I think it's worth mentioning mayonnaise as well.
I was wondering if you were going to get there.
Yes, probably. It has to be said.
Spaniards love mayonnaise. There's no doubt about it. It's everywhere.
Yes, we do, but we do it well. And I think this is a story that probably not many people know. And it's that mayonnaise was originated in Spain, in the Balearic Islands, in Mahon. Okay, in Menorca, which mm-hmm. is, Mahon is a city. And it was the French who, when they discovered it, they went back to France and said, ooh, this is the sauce of Mahon, which is the mayonnaise.
Thievery.
And it was from there that, they were just clever enough to use it. And we all know the rest of the story. It's a delicious sauce that the world loves. But it was originated in the Balearic Islands in Spain.
That is so interesting. Well, if I may officially say thank you for mayonnaise.
Thank you very much as well. I thank whoever did it as well.
Nice to talk to you, Omar.
Pleasure, Sally.
Omar Alaboy is the author of Spanish Made Simple. He shared a recipe with us, slow-cooked pork belly with mojo dulce. And Sally actually had another question for Omar about what home cooks really need to know about paella. Find all of that, plus a video of Omar showing us how to make paella at splendidtable.org. All right, let us now talk to each other. Get to us any way you like. Always, 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 you can call us 1-800-537-5252. We're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, or email us, contact@splendidtable.org. And let us know what you're thinking about. All right, let's get going. We have Laura from Tucson on the line. Hey, Laura, what would you like to talk about?
I'd like to talk about the grilling of fruit, specifically as a dessert.
Mm-hmm.
Because we live in such a hot climate, I do make every effort to plan dinners, which do not require heating the kitchen in any way. And my husband is honing his grilling skills, and we recently tried grilling our dessert for the first time, which was pineapple. I sprinkled some cinnamon on it and served it with ice cream, and it was quite delicious. So I would love some information for what I might do any differently in terms of prepping the fruit for the grill and suggestions for other fruit which would fare well on the grill. I, years ago, attempted to grill some peaches and know that something went terribly wrong. So I'm calling to ask for some grilling fruit tips.
Sure. Well, I'm glad that the pineapples worked out for you. I love pineapples, and I totally agree. A grilled pineapple is really, really wonderful when you get that nice caramelization on top. And I like them when they're not fully cooked through, so there's still a little bit of that, you know, bite and a little bit of that raw, fresh flavor in the middle. My first tip for grilling fruit is to make sure your grates are A, really nice and hot, B, really clean. So like get out that, you know, that wire brush scraper and scrape them nice and clean.
Okay.
And C, that you want to take a little bit of oil on an old rag and rub the grates just before you put the fruit on. And all three of these things will help keep the fruit from sticking. And because there's so much sugar in the fruit, it's going to caramelize very quickly. And in a lot of cases, it's going to burn char really quickly. So it's important to kind of give yourself a head start in terms of not getting it so the fruit sticks too much to the grill.
Okay, super.
All right, so now as to what fruit to do, I mean, I think you're totally right on. Pineapple is fantastic. I love the combination of pineapple and coconut.
Oh, that's
so maybe
wonderful.
If you have a coconut ice cream, that's fantastic. Or even if you just have a can of coconut milk, shake it up so you get all that nice coconut fat mixed in with the milk. Put it on your stove and start to bring it to a simmer and stir in sugar. It could be brown sugar, white sugar, whatever you like, till it's a nice sweetness, not too sweet yet. Because what I'm going to ask you to do is keep cooking it so it reduces until you have a really nice sort of coconut milk sugar. It's not going to be quite syrup consistency because the fat will start to release before it gets down to truly a syrup consistency, but you have a nice thick coconut milk and sugar sauce.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
Yeah, maybe with a little bit of lime zest in there and a little squeeze of lime. You know, that with the pineapple just on its own is fantastic, or maybe with a slice of, I don't know, something pretty neutral, like an angel food cake or a pound cake. That just sounds so good to me right now.
That sounds amazing. And what about other types of fruit?
Sure. Well, let's go to your peaches. I love grilled peaches. They can be tricky because a really good, beautiful peach that's ripe is going to be so soft and tender, and it's going to be tricky to get it so it doesn't fall apart on the grill. And maybe that's what happened with you. So I would say if you want to grill peaches, have them or maybe quarter them if they're really big. So you have a nice, big, substantial chunk. Lay the peaches on and don't let them go too long because they're going to cook real fast. And again, they're going to want char really fast. So just to get a nice marking and just to caramelize that outer layer, give them a flip, use like a nice thin spatula to get them out and see if that works for you this time. Oh, sorry. I forgot to mention, don't use a super ripe peach.
Okay.
Honestly, I think when you have a really beautiful ripe peach, the best thing you can do is just eat it over the sink. no way of like cooking it or messing with it makes it better than that moment where it's just dripping down your arm. So if you have a peach that's not quite as beautifully ripe, not quite as beautifully juicy and sweet, giving it a little time on the grill will add complexity. It'll soften it, make it seem juicier for sure. And with peaches, I love almonds. So maybe that with some ice cream and some nice toasted almonds on top. Or of course, mint is classic.
Mm.
And another thing that might be a little unusual, if you've never done before, is grilling watermelon.
Oh, I'm excited.
Yeah, watermelon and high heat go so well together, and it's not something that is super obvious to everyone. The same reason, you get that nice caramelization from all the sugar in it, but if you do it quickly enough, you still get that beautiful, fresh juiciness in the middle. And with that, I would do maybe some lemons or some lime juice to give it a little more of that spark. And I would serve that maybe with a sorbet, a little bit something lighter, or maybe like a granita with some nice basil or some nice mint.
I'm taking notes. It sounds amazing.
The nice thing about watermelon is you can get these big, thick, wide slices, right? So it can look like a really impressive thing. You can grill a big slice of it, flip it, grill the other side, just get some nice char, a little bit of nice caramelization on both sides. Keep that middle still kind of juicy and fresh. And, you know, you can lay that on a platter. It would just look magnificent, I think.
Oh, that sounds fabulous. Thank you so much.
We'll enjoy.
I will. I'm excited.
Yeah, thanks so much for the call, Laura.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And we'll be back with more of your calls and the secret edible life of daylilies. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb. All right, back to your calls. Give us a ring, 1-800-537-5252, or find us on Facebook or Twitter, or email contact@splendidtable.org. All right, let's get back to this. We have Gary calling from Pine Bluff, Wyoming. Hey, Gary, how's it going?
Good.
What should we discuss?
Slow cooker French onion soup.
All right.
I've got a recipe. We've tried it several times. The first time we made it, before we did anything but the onions and the butter and garlic, it smelled just like the best in the you ever had out. And added the rest of the ingredients, and it was still good, but it lost that French onion uniqueness.
Well, that's a good question. Now, I got to say, I'm intrigued by your question, because when you say French onion soup and you get excited about it, for me, my first thought when I was a kid, and I loved French onion soup when we would go out, you know, it would be the 70s and 80s and we'd be in these old restaurants where everything was like different shades of brown. You know, the entire restaurant is different shades of brown.
Oh, yeah.
And they always come in this brown crock. And for me, it was always about that big, huge layer of thick, bubbling cheese. But over time, especially as I learned to make it, I'm more in the camp that you're talking about now, which is it's all about that smell of the onions and the garlic. And I think the secret to a great French onion soup, regardless of the recipe, is really using a lot of onions and really, really taking the time to caramelize them, like really caramelize them.
Okay.
A lot of people think it's about the beef broth, or, you know, a lot of people think it's about the cheese, but French onion soup, it's called onion for a reason. And really what you want to do is cook your onions down and cook them and cook them and cook them, stirring pretty often, honestly, until you get them not just caramelized. And by caramelized, I don't mean, oh, browned on the outside, but still kind of pale inside, you know, when you have like a grilled onion kind of thing. I don't mean that. I mean, you cook it for such a period of time that the sugars all come out, the juices all come out, and they caramelize. So the whole onion is really melted. And it goes from a pale color to a straw color to like a brown color. And you kind of want it almost at like the coffee mahogany color.
Okay.
And honestly, for like, if you're using a couple pounds of onions, that might take you 45 minutes. It might take you an hour.
We put it in a crock pot and we went like 8 hours.
Yeah, just let it go. But don't add your liquid, don't add your broth until you get the onions to that beautiful color.
Now, is there a particular onion you should or shouldn't use?
I don't really think so. I think any kind of onion is fine. It's nice to have a variety if you want to use a little yellow onion and a little scallion. If you have some garlic and you have some leeks and you have spring onion, you know, chop them all up and throw them in there. That's fine. That makes for a nice, rich, you know, a little bit more complex flavor, but I certainly wouldn't bend over backwards to go get all those different things. I think it's really about giving it the time and the technique and stirring it so you're not burning the onions on the bottom before the rest really get that nice caramelization. And honestly, in your recipe too, you might want to think about just increasing the amount of onions. Maybe adding 50% more, heck, add double it, because all you're making is a lot more caramelized onions. And if it gets too strong, you can always just add more broth.
Yeah. So I actually ended up with a crock full of cooked onions, not start out with what was in the raw. Okay.
Yeah. And maybe you do that one day and you have something else for dinner. And then you can use that batch to bulk up or intensify your onion mm-hmm. soup. And then whatever you have left over, you have beautiful caramelized onions you can use for sandwiches, you can use for burgers.
Oh, yeah.
What I love too, with just a nice bunch of caramelized onions, honestly, with some pasta and a little bit of butter and a bunch of shaved Parmesan on top, I think that's a delicious dish on its own. So that's a great meal for me.
I will do that.
Well, thanks so much for the call, and I hope you enjoy your onion soup.
Thank you.
Take care. Again, our number, anytime we have voicemail, we are up to date in that kind of technology, is 1-800-537-5252. So one morning, our producer Sally emailed me saying, hey, I think we should do a segment on daylilies. And you know, we have these spirited conversations about what we should talk about on the show, but to be honest, I didn't know quite what to say to her. Like, daylilies? Is this, like, was it a joke? Anyway, I wrote back, well, I've been thinking about salmon collars. And she goes, I think those are hard to get for most people. So now I'm really lost because she thinks daylilies are a perfectly normal thing to have lying around, apparently. So she sends me a photo of some, and I just kind of like politely walked away from my email for the rest of the morning. And literally that afternoon, I take a walk, and sure enough, the house three doors down from me has a thatch of daylilies growing like nuts by the sidewalk. So you win, Sally. We asked our friend Hank Shaw, hunter and forager extraordinaire, to come talk to us about how to harvest and cook daylilies. So, hey, Hank, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
So, you know, obviously, before we suggest anyone go out and dig up some daylilies, we want to say consult a guidebook or consult an expert or good photos, at least. But do you have any tips on how we know we're looking at the right thing in the wild?
Absolutely. So daylilies are daylilies and lilies are lilies. And you need to know the difference because there's a number of true lilies that will kill you dead. And that's no bueno. You don't want to mess with that kind of level of toxicity. First off, chances are your daylilies are always going to be orange. And they grow in roadsides, ditches, unloved areas. So if you see a bright orange lily-looking flower in those spots, you're on the right track. And then when you get to the plant, what you're going to want to see is that a daylily is a clump. And a daylily doesn't have a bulb. A daylily has lots of little roots and tubers on them, which we'll get into. Mm. But a true lily is a bulb plant. So there is a bulb underground, and out of that bulb comes a single stalk. And on that stalk are all the flowers. So the flowers are in a spray that's timed. So in other words, the earliest buds of a true lily are on the bottom, and they flower as they go up. Another thing to know is that a true lily, their flowers will last several days and even weeks. A daylily, thus its name, will only last for one day. So the flowers on a daylily will wither within a day. The other thing about a daylily is that the leaves will be flat, and they'll have a number of what are called scapes, like garlic scapes, that will have the flowers on them. So we'll have multiple flower stalks where a lily will only have one. But what you need to check is that there could be 15 bulbs of true lilies all sitting next to each other. So if you look and it's one flower stalk all the way to the ground and there's a separation between the two, you're probably looking at lilies.
And do not eat lilies.
Do not eat lilies.
Okay, so now that we have a daylily in hand, and we know it's a daylily, not a true lily, what do we eat? What do you love about it?
This is the thing that's weird about this plant. It's like it's especially if you live where it's a weed, you're like, I want to kill it. It's horrible. Get rid of it. But it's almost a supermarket in a plant. Almost all of it is edible, and you do different things with it too. So it's pretty cool. So like the flower, if you're familiar at all with Chinese cooking, which is where they're native, by the way. And they use it a lot in hot and sour soup. And you find them as they're called like golden needles if you're looking at a Chinese market.
Yeah.
And you know what filet gumbo is? You know, the powdered sassafras?
Yeah, that you would thicken gumbo with traditionally. Yeah.
Exactly. So these flowers do the same thing for, you know, an Asian soup or any soup really. So if you use these dried or fresh flowers, there's something in them that will thicken a soup.
Cool.
They have some flavor to them. They're more pretty. So that's really what you'd use the open flower for, as a pretty edible garnish. They're sort of green beany in taste. Now, what you really want is the unopened pods. You know, and if you walk up to a daylily, you're going to find any number of them because the flowers, like I said, only flower for one day. So there's going to be a whole bunch of them waiting in the wings. And you pick them off, and they look a little bit like a tiny yellow zucchini. And it's usually about as big as your – as the New Jersey wave, your middle finger. And they don't need anything more than like a little bit of butter or olive oil and salt. And you just stir fry them or saute them super quick, you know, maybe 2 minutes. And they have a crunch like a green bean. And then the interior tastes like a squash blossom with a little bit of radish thrown in. They're really, really good. I don't know why they're not sold in like fancy trendy. Like if Eddie LaRue is listening to this, which he might be, you're going to see them at his restaurant. So that's kind of my favorite thing of the daylilies, unless you hit them in the springtime or are thinning your patch. And I remember before we were talking about how it's not a bulb. It's a series of roots that has tubers on it, just like a potato. And you pull this up and you'll notice it has what looks like little potatoes. And they're only about the size of a digit on your thumb. So they're really small. Okay. And there are you'll see two different kinds. You'll see older ones and younger ones. And the older ones are yellow. And then there'll be the new ones, which are white. And the white ones kind of look a little bit like a jicama. And that, the white ones, that's the prize. And they typically are only white in the spring because it's the New Year's tuber.
Yeah.
They are one of the most amazing things I've ever put in my mouth.
Huh. How do you cook them? What do they taste like?
You almost don't. So you clean them because they came out of the dirt. But you can saute them for just like a minute. And they taste a little bit like a cross between a jicama and a raw potato, but very sweet. So it's got a sweetness, almost carrot-like sweetness. And they're just sort of this amazing surprise from a plant that is almost universally hated. And it's kind of like nature's, you know, revenge. It's like, ha ha, you know, you hate me, but it's really, you should be paying attention to me, that kind of thing.
All right. So you can eat the flower and you really want to eat the unopened buds with some butter and just quickly sauteed. And you really, really want to eat the fresh tubers at the bottom. This is the whole produce aisle in one plant. All right, I'm going to go raid my neighbor's yard now. Thanks so much, Hank.
Thanks a lot.
Hank Shaw is the James Beard Award-winning blogger behind Hunter, Angler, Gardener, Cook. And Hank pointed out, as with any wild foods, if you're picking daylilies, please do be sure you're harvesting the right plants. Check online for photos and characteristic marks like Hank talked about before you do it. And one more thing, he did tell us that a small percentage of people, like maybe 5%, might get a little stomach upset from daylilies. It's nothing really harmful, but you might want to start slow just in case. So every week, we check in with our friends at America's Test Kitchen on what they're working on. But you know, when I was just a beginning cook, my best friend and I would share our subscription of Cook's Illustrated magazine, which is what they were called before they called themselves America's Test Kitchen. And we read every issue front to back. We were deep into it. In fact, my friend went on to work there, but we read every issue so much, we knew all their quirks, like their white-hot passion for pan-roasted chicken breasts, and their obsession with American desserts with odd names. I'm not just talking about Betty's and Buckles, I mean Slumps and Grunts and Sonkers. So I knew the day would come when they would say to us, hey, let's do a segment on the show about Sonkers. And today is that day. What is a Sonker? And how do you make a great one? That's what Tucker Shaw wanted to talk about with Sally.
Hey there, Mr. Tucker. Good to have you back.
Hey, Sally. I love being here.
So I want to talk to you about the reason we have such bizarre names for fruit desserts. I mean, I don't quite understand why there are so many. I mean, we all know what a cobbler is and a crumble. But, like, what's a Betty?
A Betty. We love a Betty.
Okay, I knew you'd know.
Right. There are so many fruit desserts that are baked that have sort of funny, silly names. And I think that has a lot to do with they're sort of fun things to eat. So why not have a goofy name? Betty is usually apples. It's layered with breadcrumbs and baked into sort of a pudding.
Okay, so kind of cobblery, kind of crumble, but what about a grunt? What's a grunt?
Oh, a grunt, also sometimes called a slump. So a grunt is very similar to a cobbler, but whereas with a cobbler you would dollop biscuit dough on top of the fruit, a grunt or a slump is baked under dumpling dough. So it's a little bit less flaky, a little bit more elastic, but no less delicious. And it's named for the sound that the dumplings make as they bake. They kind of grunt a little bit.
Oh, I love that.
I've got one more to throw at you, Sally. Have you ever heard of sonker?
No, I have not heard of sonker. What in the world is a sonker?
A sonker is a cousin of these other fruit desserts, and it's super localized in Surry County, North Carolina. And the epicenter is Mount Airy, North Carolina.
Which is Mayberry, RFD.
That's the place. You know it. Andy Griffith grew up there. They shot the show there. And in fact, if you go to Mount Airy now, you will see a lot of the exterior locations they used on this show.
And what does this dessert taste like? What is it?
It's very similar to a lot of the other baked fruit desserts, but it's much, much juicier. If you can picture a baking dish filled with super, super juicy baked fruit, either berries or peaches, covered with a relatively thin but still cakey batter, much like a pancake batter on top. And it's baked in the oven where all the flavors just deeply intensify and the top turns a lovely, lovely golden brown.
Sounds delicious.
So you start with 2 pounds of strawberries. You can also use blueberries or peaches. And this is a great place to use that fruit that's like, you know, a little bit past its prime, a little bit, you know, imperfect. Maybe it has a bruise on it. But, you know, bruise schmooze, you're going to stew the heck out of this stuff anyway.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
You can also use frozen berries here as well. You'll have to bake it for a few extra minutes, but the end result is essentially the same. So you take your berries and you combine it with a cup of sugar and a hit of salt. Then you stir it together with a very quick slurry of water and cornstarch, and this gives it just a little bit of body. You transfer this fruit to a baking dish, and you stick it in the oven for about 35 to 40 minutes. Now, meanwhile, while that's baking, you're going to whisk together a very simple and very familiar batter. It's very similar to a pancake batter. So it's flour, baking powder, a little bit of whole milk, and a lot of melted butter. I know this sounds kind of rich. We're actually using a stick of melted butter here. But here's the thing. You need to have a good amount of fat in this batter so that it floats on top of the juice. You see, that fat is lighter than water. And if you were to use a batter with less fat, it would actually sink into the juicy fruit and turn it sort of chalky, sort of not really the rich, vibrant color that you're looking for.
Okay.
So you take this batter and you drizzle it on top of the fruit, and you stick it in the oven for another half hour, maybe 3/4 of an hour, depending. And what you'll pull out of the oven will almost look like a yellow cake from the top. It will just be golden and sort of like faintly brown, and you'll stick a spoon in it and you'll just hit through that super lightly crisp top and descend into this warm, really syrupy pond of stewed fruit that is just intensified by all that time in the oven.
Wow, surprise on the bottom. It sounds beautiful.
It's gorgeous. And you must serve it in a bowl because it will just run all over your plate and be a mess. Now, sometimes in Surry County, you'll find it served with what's called dip, which is essentially a thin sugar and milk sauce that you drizzle over the top.
Huh.
But we also love it with ice cream. So I say go for the ice cream, especially in the summertime.
Yeah, absolutely. You know what else, though? What a great place for all those times when you're in the farmer's market and you see berries that are going over the hill and you don't grab them. Now you can grab them and freeze them and you've got this great dessert to make.
Totally. And you can freeze them and use frozen fruit all year round.
I love that. Great idea. Thanks, Tucker.
Thank you, Sally.
Tucker Shaw heads up the Cook's Country team at America's Test Kitchen. And you can find their recipe for lazy strawberry sonker at our website, splendidtable.org. That's great. That's like a dessert that sounds like an insult. You lazy strawberry sonker. Well, anyway, that's the show for this week. Thanks so much for listening, and please join us again. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this line from the poet E.E. Cummings. Since the thing, perhaps, is to eat flowers and not to be afraid. Now, before I go, let me say one more word about our website, splendidtable.org. It's been redesigned, it looks great, and you can find tons of recipes like Lynn and Sally's recipe for Playboy steak with preserved lemon gremolata. And if you like us, take us with you wherever you go. Subscribe to our podcast, and if you really like us, please leave us a review and dig into our archives. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Jennifer Lubke is our editor and technical director. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. And Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.